ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 7th of May. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. This Wednesday, teal turns blue. The first of the winning 2022 independents loses the seat of Goldstein back to the Liberals. And all in the mind. New treatment research offers hope for chronic pain sufferers.
I got a lot out of it. I got a lot more confidence in managing my pain, especially the emotional side of it. I never realised how much, if you are more emotional, the more your pain is.
Tensions between India and Pakistan are at risk of escalating to open war after India launched airstrikes on multiple locations in Pakistan and Pakistan-controlled Kashmir. India's government says it struck 9 locations targeting infrastructure used by terror groups, but Pakistan authorities claim some were civilian sites. Experts say a retaliatory attack is imminent, with reports of gunfire already along the Pakistan and Indian border. Kathleen O'Connor has more.
In the disputed but Pakistani-controlled region of Kashmir, residents woke to loud explosions just before 2 in the morning. Fireballs consuming the night sky, stopping traffic as concerned locals watched on.
We heard 5 or 6 huge blasts, and then the people just panicked. And then we were told to evacuate because of all the firing from the Indian side.
Reuters has reported 8 people have died, including 1 child, when one of the missiles reportedly hit a mosque. Resident Amjad Mahal and his family fled their home.
We were sleeping when we heard huge explosions, and then there was an announcement from the loudspeakers on the mosque that we needed to leave the area as soon as possible.
India says it launched missile strikes on 9 Pakistani sites that were known terrorist infrastructure in response to an attack by Islamist assailants that killed 26 Hindu tourists in Indian Kashmir last month. The terror attack putting pressure on Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi to respond, but this latest strike has political experts fearing a nuclear war. Both countries are armed with nuclear weapons. Ashok Swain is a professor of peace and conflict in Sweden.
Pakistan has made it very clear that they will use the full spectrum of their military power. And that means they are meaning nuclear power.
Pakistan authorities argue some of the strikes hit civilian areas, killing innocent men, women and children. In response, Pakistani officials have claimed a number of Indian jets and drones have been shot down by Pakistan. Aparna Pandey is the director of the Initiative of the Future of India and South Asia at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C.
Since 1989, every few years there's a terror attack inside India, which is almost always tied to a Pakistan-based terror group. There's an escalation in tensions. Since 2016, India has chosen not to restrain itself, but to conduct strikes, whether it's called the surgical strikes of 2016 or the airstrikes of 2019, or the strike that we are seeing currently, which took place. So then Pakistan responds, and normally the international community comes in and de-escalates tensions, and both countries then after a few years have conversations. Then again, the terror attack takes place. So this is a cycle on repeat.
Senior fellow at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, Raji Rajagopalan, says despite the risk of further escalation, if history is anything to go by, the country's leaders will not resort to nuclear war.
Both the Indian and Pakistani political leadership do know the limits of this particular conflict, that they cannot escalate it to a nuclear level. But I think when two countries have nuclear weapons and given the geographical proximity, one should not take things for granted. So I think one needs to be careful, mindful of what kind of actions that we engage in and what kind of responses and retaliatory actions could be taken from the other side.
Malcolm Davis is a senior analyst in defence strategy at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra. He says the international community needs to get involved.
I think that there will be both in India's and Pakistan's interests, as well as the international communities, for this to really not escalate too far and to ultimately be brought to a swift conclusion.
President Donald Trump commented in the Oval Office this morning.
No, I just hope it ends very quickly.
President Donald Trump ending that report by Kathleen O'Connor. For more on this escalating conflict at the edge of our region, Kim Herriot-Darra is a strategic and defence analyst with the Australia-India Institute. He joined me earlier.
The strategic backdrop for this is that Pakistan has had a long-running territorial dispute with India over Kashmir. Ever since the British left India as a colony and the country split into two to create the two countries, India and Pakistan. During that process, the partition, India inherited more territory for a lot of reasons that are quite complex. But the upshot is that India ended up the bigger and more powerful of the two countries. So for Pakistan, it can't really compete with India as a peer. And in the past, it's calculated that it's in its interest for other groups to conduct attacks or interference which portray Kashmiris as resisting Indian control over them and bringing Indian sovereignty into question, and doing all of that without entering into an outright military conflict.
So what would both sides want in the end of this current flare-up? What would they both want out of this?
So maybe in one sense we could start with what they don't want. Both countries have nuclear weapons and they have formidable conventional military capabilities, even if India does have the slight edge in that respect. So what neither of them wants is an outright war or the risk of a nuclear escalation. But the dilemma for them is how can they defend their perceived interests without jumping too many rungs up the escalation ladder? So for India's part, it needed its recent strikes to be strong enough and perceived to be strong enough that heightens the cost for Pakistan to support or enable attacks like this. And it needed them to be strong enough to satisfy its domestic population. But in doing that, it needs to do it in a way that doesn't squander international support or risk unintended escalation. And it really doesn't want to draw in third parties like China, which it also has contested borders with. That's why it seems to have avoided entering Pakistani territory for the strikes. And it seems to have only struck non-state groups. So it hasn't attacked Pakistani military targets. For Pakistan's part, it might calculate that it needs to respond now with force, though it's also going to need to balance its response really carefully for similar reasons.
You mentioned two potentially concerning factors to this current conflict. One, the fact that both countries are nuclear enabled, and two, their shared borders with China. Should we be concerned about either of those factors coming into play?
I think the chances are low, fortunately, but we can't be complacent about it. The good news is obviously neither India nor Pakistan wants a nuclear exchange. Certainly China doesn't want that on its doorstep, and neither does the international community. This would be a really terrible development for everyone. And because of that, I think nuclear exchange between them is unlikely for now. But the issue with these kinds of events is things move very quickly, and the potential for misunderstanding and misreading and a military adversary is always there.
What about for our own interests in the region? Would this put Australian diplomacy under a test?
So I think for now, Australia's primary interest is obviously avoiding this conflict turning into something much more serious. I think in the long term, in some ways, you might see what we have seen is a shift as Australia calibrates its relationships in South Asia. It is focused much more on its relationship with India. And we may see more pressure from India to continue that trend, particularly where cooperation with Pakistan on sensitive areas like military cooperation is concerned. India is probably going to expect us to wind down some of that cooperation and to help it in a diplomatic context, to help isolate Islamabad and place more pressure on it to dissuade Pakistan from doing what India believes it is doing.
Kim Herriot-Darra is from the Australia-India Institute. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
There's been some consolation for the coalition after its thumping election defeat, with Liberal MP Tim Wilson reclaiming the seat in Victoria of Goldstein. His win makes Zoe Daniel the first so-called teal independent to lose their seat since coming to power in 2022. But the coalition still has some major soul searching to do, with one Liberal senator calling for their nuclear policy to be dumped as a top priority. Here's Stephanie Smale.
Out with the new and back in with the former, an emotional Liberal MP Tim Wilson claiming back the electorate of Goldstein on Melbourne's Bayside.
I'm very proud.
Deep breath.
Yep. Genuinely very proud to say that we are pleased to accept that we have won the seat of Goldstein back for the Liberal Party.
Tim Wilson has ousted Zoe Daniel, the so-called teal independent, after one term in federal parliament. He concedes there are lessons to learn for the Liberal Party after its devastating election loss, but he's indicated he's keen for the nuclear policy to stay.
When I was last in parliament, I spoke favourably and because I, in my core sense of belief, believe in the role of nuclear power, not as an end, but as a beginning. We talked about this in our campaign launch. Nuclear power is part of building the future industrial base of our country.
Tim Wilson's win is a glimmer of hope after a devastating election result. But as the Liberals look at what went wrong, there are some in the party who disagree with his nuclear stance and want the policy dumped immediately.
Australians on Saturday delivered a very, very clear message to us, and I think it's very important that we listen to that message.
That's New South Wales Liberal Senator Maria Kovacic. She argues the Liberals are the party of free markets and small government, and the nuclear policy doesn't fit.
You know, the notion that a party that is meant to do that, that is the cornerstone of its values, would then nationalise a major portion of our energy system is completely at odds with who we are and what we stand for. And I think that also confused voters on the weekend because we weren't aligned with who we are.
There are others within the coalition that are still backing the nuclear power policy too, including National Senator Bridget McKenzie and the National Party leader David Littleproud. But Senator Kovacic argues it's time for dramatic change after such a dramatic defeat.
The election result was devastating. We have lost very good members of parliament. We have lost our party leader. We have lost shadow cabinet ministers. So the message from the community is very, very clear. And that's why I believe that this nuclear policy has to go.
The Liberal Party also needs to find a leader to navigate its recovery. Deputy Leader Susan Lee, Shadow Treasurer Angus Taylor and the Shadow Immigration Minister Dan Tehan are the top contenders. Political analyst and ANU Australian Studies Institute Professor Mark Kenny points out the coalition can't afford to drag out the process and promoting a woman could help.
You know, the principle of justice delayed is justice denied. And in politics, I think the same thing could be said. When you've been given a message by the voters, then I think it would pay dividends for the Liberal Party to make some gestures that show it has listened to that verdict from the people and done so in a timely way. Putting a woman in and one who is more from the moderate side of the party would send at least some constructive signals to the electorate.
There hasn't been a female opposition leader for either party in Australian politics. Mark Kenny says boosting the profile of women in the coalition team could help the party win back voter support.
The Liberal Party has done a lot of sort of gum flapping about this and said that it won't go for quotas. And we see the result playing out now.
ANU political analyst Mark Kenny ending that report by Stephanie Smale. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. As Donald Trump's tariffs continue to rock confidence around the world, one of Australia's banking bosses thinks our economy can weather the storm as long as China's economy remains strong. But National Australia Bank Chief Executive Andrew Irvin says Australia is exposed if a tariff hit China cuts back on importing lucrative commodities like iron ore and coal. Earlier, I spoke with the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, you've been speaking with Andrew Irvin. How confident is he given the uncertainty about the Trump tariffs and a global trade war?
Well, Andy, cautiously confident. This morning, Andrew Irvin revealed a 2.5% fall in statutory net profit to $3.4 billion. Cash profit, which the bank likes to use as a preferred measure, up a slender 1% to $3.5 billion. But away from these bottom line numbers, Mr. Irvin referred to challenging conditions, optimistic about growth in Australia and New Zealand, but noting these escalating global trade tensions as a key source of uncertainty. This morning, he also watched the latest Oval Office event, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney diplomatically telling Donald Trump, who sees Canada as the 51st state, that Canada is not for sale. A flashing sign of trade tensions, though, he is confident there could be an easing of tensions if diplomacy works.
Look, it's certainly been an interesting few weeks. It's my view that no one wins in the trade war. And my hope is that the U.S. administration will start to announce some bilateral trade deals. And there's even talk about potentially reducing some of the excess tariffs on China.
We're not greatly exposed here in Australia, but what if China, our biggest trading partner, is hurt and slows down buying Australian commodities, agricultural products or services? That could be quite damaging.
Yeah, you're right to say that the direct impacts on Australia are modest. Only a single digits of our exports go to the US. But you're right to say that China is a source of uncertainty for us.
Anthony Albanese had a historic landslide victory at the weekend. Is that clear result and stability going to help insulate Australia in an increasingly uncertain world?
I think it does, Peter. It's a strong election mandate, and that provides stability and it provides certainty. Treasurer Chalmers has also said that in the second term of the Albanese government, there's going to be more focus on productivity. And I welcome that comment. And I look forward to working with the Treasurer and his government so that we can see the policies and the levers Australia needs to drive productivity.
It's clear the world economic order has changed dramatically and Donald Trump is America first. Strong relationships have been tested. What's this doing to certainty and stability in the banking sector?
You know, again, Australia's in a good place. We have some of the strongest banks in the world. And what's really important for us is that we're able to lend through thick and thin. I think we're through the worst of it. Obviously, we've got to make sure that these global trade tensions don't knock us off our path.
Just on interest rates, they look almost certain to be cut by the Reserve Bank on May the 20th and maybe more to come. How's our economy going to be looking with rates coming down potentially dramatically?
We're predicting 4 cash rate cuts by the end of the year. We think domestic growth will be 2% or more for 2025, which is a lot better than last year.
That's the National Australia Bank Chief Executive Andrew Irvin with Peter Ryan. And Peter, a big morning for the banking sector with the corporate watchdog ASIC accusing Macquarie Bank of significant compliance failures. Tell me about that.
Well, that's right. ASIC's imposed further restrictions on Macquarie Bank for what it calls years of multiple and significant compliance failures relating to Macquarie's futures dealing business and its reporting on over-the-counter derivatives trade. ASIC's referred to 375,000 derivatives transactions on 7 occasions. ASIC's now put additional restrictions on Macquarie's financial services license, which is a big deal, and is now ordering it to prepare a remediation plan to address the failures, to appoint an independent expert to review and report on what's going on to put things right, to ensure that Macquarie meets those license obligations.
Peter Ryan there. Living with chronic pain is never easy. It can be made even harder by those who might treat sufferers like it's all in their head. But now, new research is finding that pain can be alleviated with the right mental frame of mind. And a trial program is providing help to those who endure constant and debilitating symptoms. Here's Nick Grimm.
For Geelong woman Janelle Blight, the chance to volunteer again at this year's Avalon Air Show sent her spirit soaring.
And the last time that I volunteered for it was over 15 years ago. So that was good. That was really good.
And it was something she'd never thought she'd do again. A former competitive swimmer, squash player and netballer, the 61-year-old was always active until chronic pain took over her life and made even the simplest of tasks an ordeal.
Even just getting out of bed or going for a walk or brushing the dog, you've just got to think, oh God, that's going to hurt.
In her case, shoulder and knee replacements, arthritic pain and a lung condition have all played a part. But it all changed when Janelle Blight joined a trial program run by the University of New South Wales and Neuroscience Australia, helping chronic pain sufferers to improve their emotional well-being. It didn't put a stop to her pain, but it did make it more bearable and easier to endure.
I never realised how much, if you are more emotional, the more your pain is. the more exacerbated it is. I also was able to reduce my morphine, which has been really good.
She felt more energetic. She was also much more happy and her well-being increased, and she could do things she couldn't do before.
Professor Sylvia Gustin helped develop the program, which saw 89 participants taken through group-based online sessions guided by a pain therapist, followed up with individual self-directed learning via an app and handbook. It was developed in response to earlier research showing chronic pain causes pathological changes to neurochemicals in the brain, leading researchers to the conclusion those changes can be treated like any other physical affliction.
It's the same, you have a stroke, and a stroke has a pathological change to your brain, and you need to recover from it. How do you recover? You actually train your body and your brain, and that's the same with our program. So you train the brain and you train your body with skills. It's an emotional skill set.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do say, look, pain is all in the head.
Study co-author Dr. Nell Norman-Knott.
Pain is nevertheless incredibly real, incredibly traumatic. People live with it for many, many years. Using very simple skills in emotion dysregulation, we helped people be able to better calm down their emotions and in doing so change their pain intensity.
And with chronic pain sufferers typically experiencing higher rates of depression, anxiety and suicide than the general population, anything that can lessen the load felt by sufferers is welcomed by those like Janelle Blight.
During the course gave me a bit more self-esteem, a bit more confidence in the way you deal with it and how you manage and adapt and change your life around.
Chronic pain sufferer Janelle Blight, ending that report by Nick Grimm. And if this story's raised concerns for you or anyone you know, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Well, you probably know you're being watched by CCTV in public places, public streets. But what if your face, even the way you walk, was being scrutinised by artificial intelligence? Melbourne City Council is considering the use of video analytics to help target crime and antisocial behaviour, replicating a program in Logan, south of Brisbane. But privacy advocates have concerns, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
If it seems AI is everywhere, you're right. It might even be watching you as you walk down the street.
See, we didn't want people to feel like Big Brother was watching, but we did want them to know that our camera work wasn't just for show.
John Raven is the mayor of Logan City Council, south of Brisbane. Logan began using AI software linked to its CCTV network 12 months ago.
Its main purpose is to be able to take 1,400 cameras across the city that are recording 24/7 and make it easy to search those, either by time, location, or by some kind of identifying feature. Once you've got someone the police are interested in, they can tag that person in the system, and based on what they're wearing, the car that they get in and out of, they can actually monitor their movements across the city.
It's a capability Melbourne City Council is now keen to replicate. Council's decided to review a possible expansion of its CCTV network, including the potential for video analytics powered by artificial technology. Nick Rees is Melbourne's Lord Mayor.
In terms of video analytics, yes, we've asked for advice on whether AI technology can be used to help us detect things from everything from dump trolleys, tracking vehicles through license plate ID, or potentially biometric ID as well.
Biometric ID is the identification of physical or behavioural characteristics such as facial recognition, voice, or how a person walks. Nick Rees says the review will carefully consider privacy and human rights limitations.
And look, that's what this review is going to do, is it's essentially saying, do the benefits outweigh the privacy implications?
Police in Victoria currently use AI to assist in serious crimes, but this review will look to broaden the use of cameras and AI to detect lesser crimes or disturbances, including graffiti and vandalism.
The truth is, Melbourne is a very safe city, but we do have problem areas and we do have problem behaviours as well. And so the question really is, can we use some of these new technologies, balance them up against privacy implications, and will there be public benefit that come from that?
But there are significant privacy considerations in the broad use of AI surveillance, including the use of third-party providers.
Lizzie O'Shea is the founder and chair of Digital Rights Watch.
At a federal level, at least, the Privacy Commissioner has expressed significant concern about the practices of AI technology used in facial recognition. So I accept that local councils may not be using that technology, but it's quite clear that the Privacy Commissioner is very concerned about that.
She says even without AI, the expansion of CCTV networks also needs to be monitored closely.
You may have footage taken of you for one purpose. It may then be used for another purpose. It's unclear how that is regulated and who's responsible if you don't like it.
Melbourne City Council has approximately 200 CCTV cameras and is proposing a doubling of its CCTV network.
Bridget Fitzgerald, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hello, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The votes are still being counted, but when the new parliament is formed, it's already clear there will be more female MPs in it than ever before. But fewer than 10 of them will be sitting on the coalition benches. Today, the ABC's Annabelle Crabb on whether the coalition can ever win back the female vote. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.